Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Rajagaha on Mount Vulture Peak. Now, on that occasion, the Venerable Sona was dwelling at Rajagaha in the cool grove. Then, while the Venerable Sona was alone in seclusion, the following course of thought arose in his mind. I am one of the Blessed One's most energetic disciples, yet my mind has not been liberated from the taints by non-clinging. Now, there is wealth in my family, and it is possible for me to enjoy my wealth and do meritorious deeds. Let me then give up the training and return to the lower life, so that I can enjoy my wealth and do meritorious deeds. Then, having known with his own mind the course of thought in the Venerable Sona's mind, just as a strong man might extend his drawn-in arm, or draw in his extended arm, the Blessed One disappeared on Mount Vulture Peak and appeared in the cool grove in the presence of the Venerable Sona. The Blessed One sat down on the seat prepared for him. The Venerable Sona paid homage to the Blessed One and sat down to one side. The Blessed One then said to him, Sona, when you were alone in seclusion, didn't the following course of thought arise in your mind? I am one of the Blessed One's most energetic disciples, yet my mind has not been liberated from the taints by non-clinging. Now there is wealth in my family, and it is possible for me to enjoy my wealth and do meritorious deeds. Let me then give up the training and return to the lower life, so that I can enjoy my wealth and do meritorious deeds. Yes, Bhante. Tell me, Sona, in the past, when you lived at home, weren't you skilled at the lute? Yes, Bhante. What do you think, Sona? When its strings were too tight, was your lute well-tuned and easy to play? No, Bhante. When its strings were too loose, was your lute well-tuned and easy to play? No, Bhante. But Sona, when its strings were neither too tight nor too loose, but adjusted to a balanced pitch, was your lute well-tuned and easy to play? Yes, Bhante. So too, Sona, if energy is aroused too forcefully, this leads to restlessness. And if energy is too lax, this leads to laziness. Therefore, Sona, resolve on a balance of energy, achieve evenness of the spiritual faculties, and take up the object there. Yes, Bhante, the Venerable Sona replied. When the Blessed One had finished giving the Venerable Sona this exhortation, just as a strong man might extend his drawn-in arm or draw in his extended arm, he disappeared in the cool grove and reappeared on Mount Vulture Peak. Then, some time later, the Venerable Sona resolved on a balance of energy, achieved evenness of the spiritual faculties, and took up the object there. Then, dwelling alone, withdrawn, heedful, ardent, and resolute, in no time the Venerable Sona realized for himself with direct knowledge in this very life that unsurpassed consummation of the spiritual life, for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forth from the household life into homelessness. And having entered upon it, he dwelled in it. He directly knew, destroyed is birth, the spiritual life has been lived, and what had to be done has been done. There is no more coming back to any state of being. And the Venerable Sona became one of the Arahants. Having attained Arahantship, the Venerable Sona thought, let me go to the Blessed One and declare final knowledge in his presence. Then he approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down to one side and said, Bhante, when a bhikkhu is an Arahant, one whose taints are destroyed, who has lived the spiritual life, done what had to be done, laid down the burden, reached his own goal, utterly destroyed the fetters of existence, and become completely liberated through final knowledge, he is intent upon six things: on renunciation, on solitude, on non-affliction, on the destruction of craving, on the destruction of clinging, and on non-confusion. It may be, Bhante, that some Venerable One here thinks, could it be that this Venerable One is intent upon renunciation on account of mere faith? But it should not be seen in such a way. A bhikkhu with taints destroyed, who has lived the spiritual life and done his task does not see in himself anything further to be done or any need to increase what has been done. He is intent upon renunciation because he is devoid of lust through the destruction of lust, because he is devoid of hatred through the destruction of hatred, because he is devoid of delusion through the destruction of delusion. It may be that some venerable one here thinks, could it be that this venerable one is intent upon solitude because he is hankering after gain, honour and praise? But it should not be seen in such a way. A bhikkhu with taints destroyed who has lived the spiritual life and done his task does not see in himself anything further to be done or any need to increase what has been done. He is intent upon solitude because he is devoid of lust through the destruction of lust, because he is devoid of hatred through the destruction of hatred, because he is devoid of delusion through the destruction of delusion. It may be that some venerable one here thinks, could it be that this venerable one is intent upon non-affliction because he has fallen back on the wrong grasp of behaviour and observances as the essence? But it should not be seen in such a way. A bhikkhu with taints destroyed, who has lived the spiritual life and done his task, does not see in himself anything further to be done or any need to increase what has been done. He is intent upon non-affliction because he is devoid of lust through the destruction of lust, because he is devoid of hatred through the destruction of hatred, because he is devoid of delusion through the destruction of delusion. He is intent upon the destruction of craving, because he is devoid of lust through the destruction of lust, because he is devoid of hatred through the destruction of hatred, because he is devoid of delusion through the destruction of delusion. He is intent upon the destruction of clinging, because he is devoid of lust through the destruction of lust, destruction of hatred, destruction of delusion. He is intent upon non-confusion, because he is devoid of lust through the destruction of lust, through the destruction of hatred, through the destruction of delusion. Bhante, when a bhikkhu is thus perfectly liberated in mind, even if powerful forms cognizable by the eye come into range of the eye, they do not obsess his mind. His mind is not at all affected. It remains steady, attained to the imperturbability, and he observes its vanishing. Even if powerful sounds cognizable by the ear come into range of the ear, odours by the nose, tastes by the tongue, tactile objects by the body, or phenomena recognizable by the mind, coming range of the mind, they do not obsess his mind. His mind is not at all affected. It remains steady, attained to imperturbability, and he observes its vanishing. Suppose, Bhante, there were a stone mountain with clefts, without clefts or fissures, one solid mass. If a violent rainstorm should come from the east, it could not make it quake, wobble, or tremble. If a violent rainstorm should come from the west, north, or south, it could not make it quake, wobble, or tremble. So too, when a bhikkhu is thus perfectly liberated in mind, even if powerful forms cognizable by the eye come into the range of the eye, even if phenomenal, powerful phenomena cognizable by the mind come into the range of the mind, they do not obsess his mind. His mind is not at all affected. It remains steady, attained to imperturbability, and he observes its vanishing. If one is intent on renunciation and solitude of mind, if one is intent on non-affliction and the destruction of clinging, if one is intent on craving's destruction and non-confusion of the mind, when one sees the sense bases arising, one's mind is completely liberated. For a bhikkhu of peaceful mind, one completely liberated, there's nothing further to be done, no need to increase what has been done. As a stone mountain, one solid mass, is not stirred by the wind, so no forms and tastes, sounds, odours and tactile objects and phenomena, desirable or undesirable, stir the stable one's mind. His mind is steady and freed, and he observes its vanishing. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Rightio. There's a fair bit to that sutta on Sona. So as I was mentioning this morning, with regards to the simile of the lute, or the You can say violin, whatever. If the strings are too tight or too loose, it doesn't play a good tune. In the same way, when we're practicing meditation, if we go too far in terms of exertion of energy or the rousing of energy, then we become restless. If we don't exert enough energy, then we become lazy. And you'll find anyone who's serious about meditation, has practiced for a long period of time, has probably gone through this time and time again. You can be at home or you can be on a retreat. It doesn't actually make a difference. It's not the location, it's the mind which makes a difference here. And so the issue is, when we come to sit to practice, what is our mind up to? If we feel maybe a bit tired, you've all come from work, probably around Melbourne, or maybe travel a fair bit. And so all of this travelling and moving around requires energy. All this moving and travelling around can also stimulate energy. So it's always a case when we're practicing of balancing this energy or lack of energy. When we're tired, we sit here and we kind of do the nodding meditation. So we're kind of going in nods up. Because the mind is tired, your running around may have created fatigue for the body and fatigue for the mind. On the other hand, there are some people who are energized by running around. Well, they think they're energized by running around. What this does is just stirs up the energy in the body, stirs up the energy in the mind, and they become restless. So they're sitting there doing the Ray Charles, you know, from side to side like this. Not this head business. Kind of like always moving, always trying to find the ultimate position on the cushion. Right? Of course, it doesn't exist. When the mind is restless, there's no ultimate position on the cushion because the mind is making a problem of things. If your mind is peaceful, you could pretty much sit on anything, just about, as long as it wasn't dangerous. You could just about sit on anything, all right? And your mind will go into deep peace. And the body will become irrelevant to the mind at that point. And when you come out, you realize you've cut off circulation to 3/4 of your body, but it doesn't really matter because it doesn't bother you because the mind is so peaceful. And also at that point, the heart rate drops anyway when you're very peaceful in your meditation, so you're not worried about all of these issues. You're not going to have a heart attack during a very peaceful meditation. You'll have it if you're trying to run around like a crazy person, which is what we tend to do most of the time when we're busy. So here the Buddha is talking about a balancing of the faculties so that you can arrive at a steady mean and means and mode of practice. And here he mentions the spiritual faculties. So for those of you who are not familiar with what the spiritual faculties are, faith. It says here conviction. I don't like the term faith all that much because kind of has connotations of blindness, just pure belief without any understanding. And I much prefer Venerable Brahmali's interpretation of sadha, the Pali word sadha, to mean conviction. And you can only have conviction through experience, direct experience, not through hearsay of somebody else or through some concept of I believe. Yes, I believe I should have a bank account is different to I have a big bank account, right? There's a big difference between the two. And so with a practice, conviction should come through. When you practice the Buddha's teaching, it's not about, oh, I have faith that it will be helpful for me. It should be directly visible here and now. All right? It's not something that you believe. It's actually something you experience. So that's number one, is that conviction. Number two, energy, and another word for it is persistence. So energy just doesn't mean like physical energy. I've just had a meal, so now I've got a lot of energy. Right? Not like that. Persistence and energy meaning is that drive to keep going, that drive to keep practicing. This is what persistence means, and energy, the term wirya in Pali, to keep going. Not to give up. So this is the second of the spiritual faculties. The next one, mindfulness. It's probably been done to death. But referring to the four satipatthanas is what mindfulness is about. The four satipatthanas, being aware of body, being aware of feelings, being aware of the mind, and being aware of Dhamma, or Dhamma's phenomena. So mindfulness means when you're staying with one of those four bases. So this is referring to the four jhanas. So that's number four. Number five is wisdom, or understanding. So this refers to understanding knowledge of the Four Noble Truths. It doesn't mean having read them, you understood them. No more than having conviction is the same as having a belief in something. You might believe in unicorns, but you'll only ever have conviction if you've ever met one in real life. I can't say I've met somebody who's met a unicorn in real life. So what we're talking about a conviction in are things which are real, things which can be experienced, tangible, and that others can share in that kind of experience as well. This is important. Otherwise, it's just maybe I've got a crazy delusion. I saw God the other day riding on a pink leprechaun, and they went to the park to feed a whole flock of unicorns. Okay, if I just have that experience and nobody else has had it, doesn't really make it something very tangible. It's just something up in my own head. But if there's some sort of instruction that we give and others are able to replicate that instruction and the feelings or the experiences therein, that gives us a higher degree of confidence that it isn't mass delusion, but it is actually a common principle which can be realized by oneself. And at that point, it becomes conviction. So the Buddha's teachings, the suttas, his talks on meditation, the outcomes of karma, these kinds of things can be experienced by anybody if undertaken and practiced according to those instructions. No different to if you're baking a cake, you mix the ingredients as per the recipe and you'll end up with a cake if you follow the instructions properly.
And depending on the altitude.
And depending on the altitude, yes. Okay. Well, that could apply to a lot of things, I suppose, like climbing Mount Everest. Yes, bring your oxygen tank for most people. So those five aspects need to actually be balanced. That is conviction, persistence, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. And wisdom amongst all of these, the Buddha says, is the chief. It's like if you had a kitchen, you got a whole bunch of chefs in a kitchen, but there's one chef who rules them all, and that's the master chef. The master chef is wisdom, all right? Master chef understands I'm lacking in energy. I need more energy. And wisdom informs that aspect of your practice. I need to increase the energy in my practice. I need to keep trying, not to give up, not to just sit in the corner and, you know, dig things from underneath my toenails because I'm despondent. I haven't attained first jhana within the first 5 minutes of the retreat. Boo-hoo. So energy needs to be roused to keep trying. When I was over in Burma, and now I'm going all anecdotal, so I'm going away from the sutta right now. When I was over in Burma, I was on a retreat for 3 months. It was a silent retreat, so it was very nice. And there was one lady there, and I had a chat with her during the retreat. We have to edit that part out. We were walking. I was a layman at that time. I wasn't a monk. So I'm safe on that aspect. We keep that part in. We do an hour walking meditation up this top paddock or whatever in the retreat centre. And as we were coming back in towards the meditation hall, she told me about her coming to these retreats. And that was her 10th retreat. Her 10th 3 month noble silent retreat. She goes every year. And she said it was only that year that she ever had any experience of this thing called nimitta, the light in the mind, so to speak, which is the basis for jhana practice. So she said, oh, you know, I come every year and nothing, because the particular teacher on this retreat is always hamming up it was a nun. She's always hamming up the importance of nimittas. You must see the nimitta, you must see the nimitta, it must be clear, it must be bright, it must be like this. So when you kind of hear that kind of instruction, year after year, it's like, I'm not seeing anything apart from frustration, right? That's the only thing I'm seeing right now, a desire for this and the not getting of that. And that's what she saw for 9 years. On that 10th year, and it was the year that I was there, she said to me, this year, I actually had nimittas come up in my meditation. And I went, sadhu. It was really good. I was very happy for her. Not in a kind of backstabbing, jealous way with a fake smile. It was true happiness. I was really happy for her. You know, and I think that's real practice. It's not these people you hear about, oh, I got into jhana on my second retreat, and, or, you know, it was like 3 weeks of practice and I went into jhana. Although a lot of those stories I find quite dubious anyway. But at any rate, it's not those I see as the great practitioners. It is those who are persistent and those who keep going, those who don't give up. No matter what the obstacles are in your practice, you overcome that. When I was in the army, we had this, I think, this saying, to overcome, to adapt and survive, to defeat the enemy. Now, here in this retreat, we're not carrying AK-47s. We're not trying to kill each other or others. Well, what the enemy is for us as meditators is greed, hatred, and delusion. What the enemy for us as meditators is expectation. This is your greatest enemy, expectation. You're sitting there thinking, I'm going to get to this stage. I'm going to have this kind of experience in this retreat. I'm going to think people around me are going to behave to me in this way. They're all going to be nice, floating above the ground, shining lights everywhere, beaming smiles at me when I, you know, put something dirty on their plate unmindfully, or put some slop on the floor and leave it there as they're watching me thinking, this person's unmindful. This is the enemy for us in our practice. This is expectation, our wanting something to be a certain way. It's the difference between what is present here and now and what is in the future. That's what expectation is. It's the difference between the present and the future. Our projections into what we should be experiencing now, pulling it from the future to bring it into the now. But the problem is the future doesn't exist, and nor does the past. All we have is the now. So if we go off onto this expectation side of things, we just bring a lot of suffering into our practice that wasn't there previously. So if we take that aspect away, if we take the expectation away, we just have right here, right now, our direct experiences with things. We're not sitting there going, I hope this Dhamma talk finishes quickly. I hope it goes longer because that means I have to go back to meditation and it kind of sucks right now. It's so hard. This is day one. This is when you kind of you hit the wall. You've just come from being really ultra busy and now you're coming to something which is kind of quiet. It's like, you know, throwing boiling water on a windscreen in the middle of winter for your car. It tends to crack the screen. It can't handle the stress because it's such a radical change so quickly. And for a lot of you, it will be like that. For most of us, it is. But it's okay. If you don't expect anything, it's okay. It's just more change. Previously, I was thinking like this 24 hours ago. Now I'm thinking like this. It's changed. It's different. It's okay. It's the nature of impermanence. And the more we make peace with impermanence, the easier things become for us. We don't have this big battle. We don't have this big struggle anymore. And it's that struggle which drains our energy. If you're thinking, why am I tired? After a few days into a retreat, why am I tired? It's because you're fighting. You're fighting with how things actually are in the present moment. You're not allowing change to come into your life. So allow that change to come through. Don't resist it. You see these changing feelings that you have, that's natural. It comes and goes. The things that you see, the things that you hear, the things that you taste, the things that you touch, the things that you think about, all of these things are movable, like illusions. They keep shifting. Here today, gone tomorrow. Here this minute, gone the next. Here in this very second, disappearing in the next. sometimes persisting for a long time. Oh, it's so painful. Oh, my knees, it's so painful. Oh, my painful knees. And as long as you keep thinking about it, yeah, it'll be painful. It'll be worse, actually. It's twice as worse because you're adding the mental affliction to the physical affliction. If it was just a physical affliction, well, it wasn't here an hour ago, so it'll move away eventually. It can't be there forever. Nothing stays the same forever, especially not with your body. It's one of the most inconsistent things there is out there. It keeps changing. You get this illusion it's all together and it's all one piece, but no. I'll go get a gallbladder operation. Hopefully within the next 3 months, when they say operation, just rip it out. It's like spare parts. I've had my tonsils removed, my appendix removed, and now the gallbladder. I said, take the lungs. I don't need the silly things anyway. Take them out. I can't get lung cancer then, can I? Think of the benefits, right? The more they take out, the less that can go wrong. Well, to a degree. And take the heart out, I might have some trouble. 1 minute worth of fun, maybe suffering. But at any rate, the difference between good meditators and poor meditators is the ability to balance these faculties, to understand, to balance your practice. You can't think, although people will think, but you shouldn't think that I'm going to do exactly the same practice that I did yesterday. I had a really great sit in the hall here. It's 4 o'clock in the morning. I was here before any other person turned up, which meant that I'd had at least an hour-long run before the noisy people roll up. So this is what I used to do when I was on retreat. As a layman, I'd get into the hall at 2 o'clock in the morning to beat the rush. Well, there wasn't much of a rush, but I called it a rush anyway. At 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock in the morning, I like to get the early bird discount, right? 2 or 3 hours of quietness in the hall before the rest of the village turned up. So I didn't have to listen to this one coughing, that one opening and closing things, as people like to open and close things, that one with the plastic bag, and the other one with synthetic clothing. You know. Synthetic clothing is everywhere. Jumpers are everywhere, even in tropical climates, for some strange reason. So at any rate, I try to beat the rush, right, and get in there early and not have to worry about all these other noises and people movement and stuff like this. And so I kept pushing and pushing and pushing. Now, in about 4 weeks into the meditation retreat, my body started not to like it too much. I was doing about 20 hours of sitting or walking meditation every day. Sometimes less than about 4 hours of sleep or less per night, sometimes 2 hours a night, because I thought I was being a bit lazy. Yeah, and I didn't need it. At that point, brightness was in the mind, so I don't need the sleep. And sometimes I'd just be sitting there going, I'll lie down, and I'd just be thinking, I'm just lying down for the sake of, you know, I'm just sick of sitting. So I just lie down and go, when will this go? But I just have all this energy, so I can't fall asleep anyway. So then I get back up and I go off to the hall again. And typically, I sit on the floor, cross-legged, different styles of cross-legged, but just basically cross-legged sitting on the floor. Pushing, 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 pushing. And after 4 weeks, I actually started to have spasms going through my shoulders and my arms. It's kind of like shaking like this. I'm thinking, geez, what's going on with this? Is the food that bad on this retreat? Although I was sick after week two. Yeah. So my body condition wasn't that fantastic. It was hot and there's a lot of chili, right? And the water quality wasn't very good. This is not in Australia. So at any rate, so all of this is kind of happening to the body, and so I started to get a bit frustrated with the practice. Well, I'm feeling all this pain or this discomfort going through the body, and I thought, oh, when is this going to settle down? So at that point I thought, I'm pushing too hard, and I was. You know, 2 hours a night sleep to 4 hours a night sleep, I'm pushing it. And I was a bit tense. I'm wanting to get somewhere in my practice. This was the problem. It's this big push. It's the push of expectation coming through. So what I did, I eased off. I slacked right off. I went to like 5 hours or 6 hours of sleeping a night, you know, taking it easy. Hung out in my kuti, my room more. I was very fortunate because I had a room to myself, everybody else pretty much. was three to a room. Maybe like some of you are, two to a room, I think is the worst. Maybe there might be three to a room in certain places here, but majority is two to a room. And so one night I'm sitting there and I'm sitting on a chair. I said, to hell with the floor. I had enough. I'm going to sit on the chair. You know, it's good to look like a Buddha statue all the time, but again, another expectation. Good meditation only occurs when you look like a Buddha statue, breaking your ankles. So I sat on the chair, and I remember when this happened because it stood out to me as one of the highlights on the retreat. And I think I had maybe 2 or 3 hours before the next session in the hall. It was a Dhamma talk by the nun. And I thought, I was just going to sit here in the chair. I pulled the blinds down, went to, I like dark. To me, I like dark places. Like when meditating, dark is good, not too light. And so I'm sitting there on this chair, like the back row contestants here, just sitting on just an average chair, like what you're sitting on, nothing special. It didn't say meditation 1000, you know, on it or anything like that, or jhana or bust on the back. It didn't have anything like that. Just a standard chair. And I sat there. I had no expectations because it's a chair. You know, people go to KFC, sit on chairs, right? Not meditation. And so I'm sitting there, and then the mind started to become peaceful, started to settle. Lights start to come to the mind. And then the strongest light that you would ever see in your whole life came to my mind. If you think the sun is bright, it's nothing. It really is nothing. You can stare at the sun and take a Pepsi challenge at the same time. It's easy. But the kind of light that I'm talking about is as if there's 100,000 suns in your mind, if you can imagine that. That's how bright it is. And the peace that comes from that surpasses anything that you have ever experienced in your life, in terms of eating food or going out and watching movies or listening to music or blah, 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 blah. Nothing. No compare. And it was because of one thing that happened, and only one thing. I let go of my expectations. I dropped the thinking. Meditation means sitting in lotus on a cushion in a hall. Meditation means, you know, being uptight and pushing, 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 pushing to get somewhere. It was because of the opposite of all of this kind of thing that the mind actually went into peace. So the same for yourself. It won't be any different. This is something I can repeat this experiment over and over. It's the same all the time. The more I want to push, the more I want, the less I will get. It's almost like a principle in nature. The more greedy you are, the less you might get. You might get it initially, but you'll lose it eventually. And that's the nature of greed. When you give, things come back to you. It's kind of like a boomerang. You throw it away and it kind of comes back. If you're not careful, it hits you in the head. But the nature of giving, when you give, and the Buddha talks about this, those people who are generous, those people who are giving, it comes back. It usually comes back in a bigger way than when it goes out. As long as it's the right intention, not I'm giving so I can get something back. That's still greed. It's not the right intention. So when you're giving, you give to your practice. And what are you giving? Freedom from expectation. Give yourself freedom from expectations. When you come here, don't expect anything. Don't expect anything from the environment. I want it to be this hot, not that hot. I want it to be this cold, not that cold. My bed is too cold. My bed is too hot. My bed is too soft. My bed is too hard. That person's not kind. This person is too angry. I'm not happy. They should be happy. You drop all of that. Just come in and just, I don't expect anything from this monk. If that's the attitude that you have, you'll do the best. If you expect me to help you in some way, shape or form, or to make your practice better somehow, that's just delusion. That's not how it works. Better to drop it. And then if something is just sitting there, you're listening to some sort of talk, and then there might be just one fragment of that whole talk which sticks and helps you in your practice, then that's great. But if you expect, you're hanging there with expectation, I want him to talk about this. He's got to talk about that. I don't, I'm not interested in this. I'm not interested in that. And the fault-finding mind comes up. And when that fault-finding mind comes up, it pulls your practice apart as well. Why can't I sit for 2 hours straight? Why can't I sit for an hour straight? Why can't I sit for half an hour without fidgeting around like this, rocking around? These are all expectations. Expectation is based on desire. The desire for changing the present moment to something other than what it actually is. Whereas if you just accept the present, this is what's happening right now. And it's fine. It doesn't have to be any other way. It's okay. If you go this way, you cruise through. You'll cruise through these next 5 days. You'll think nothing of it. Just like, wow, that went quick. For those of you who are thinking right now, oh, geez, I've got another 5 days of this. You're already in expectation mode. Things aren't going the way you want it. It's kind of like, you know, well, life is like that, isn't it? Things sometimes just don't go the way you want. Actually, more often than not, it doesn't. You know, I'm going to be a nuclear scientist when I get it. Well, and I, you know, I'm ending up, you know, driving taxis. Who knows? Things keep changing. Life takes unexpected turns. If anything to expect, it should be the unexpected. You should expect change. Then you're at least you're in line with the Buddha's teaching of impermanence. Expect change. Maybe you should get T-shirts. You know, expect change. Just take a look at it and put it in reverse. Every time you look in the mirror, you can see expect change. Then when you see that, oh, you, of course. With this wrinkle, look at the shirt. It's in reverse, so when you see in the mirror, it actually makes sense to you. Yeah. People on the street look at it like, what is it? What does this person mean? Well, they actually make them stare at your shirt and try to figure it out. So that's how you can teach Dhamma, maybe. But expect change. And if you do that, you'll be fine. You'll be okay. You'll sit there and whatever's happening, it's fine. Doesn't matter. If you sit there and you're just frustrated, you just think, okay, this is just frustration. Where does this frustration come from? Oh, expectation. I want some whiz-bang fireworks to happen in my mind. I want to get enlightened right now. Some flash of insight comes through. The insight can't come through when you're too busy, you know, chatting to yourself. I don't like the person sitting next to me making all that noise. I don't like the window being open. Oh, this air conditioner is noisy. Oh, on Tuesday I've got a meeting with that guy. I wonder if he's going to get that thing done, organised for me for the report. And I was going, but Cynthia was actually going to feed back to me about that particular thing. And then you listen outside and all you're hearing is the cockatoos going, rang, rang, rang. And then you might have a flash of insight. Oh, no different. Where was I? Okay, yeah, that's right. Melbourne Cup retreat weekend's coming up and then I've got to do... It's all the same. You're just like the cockatoos bantering outside. It's cockatoo, animal talk going through your mind. At least they don't have any expectations. They're ahead of you. You're like walking around with a high-powered gun and you're choosing to throw stones. They don't have a high-powered gun, but they're just throwing stones. At least they're in the present moment, you know? Probably to a greater degree. They're not thinking about next week. The cockatoo's just going, oh, look, food, eat. That's now. Okay? So the animals are ahead of us more often than not. You know, they can just sit there. Some of those spiders, you just have to be amazed. When you go outside, you see a spider web. You just see the spiders thinking, you can sit longer than I can. How long you been there, buddy? 4 hours tonight? 5 hours? You haven't shifted yet, waiting for that moth to hit the net. All right? Animals are ahead of us. More often than not, when it comes to sitting, they're there. Of course, they may not have the other spiritual faculties there. The wisdom faculty, no, not very strong for the poor old animals. Neither is the jhana factor going to happen for them either. Right? But they have mindfulness, yes. If they want to eat, they need to be mindful. They're not going to catch anything if they're not. They'll have energy and persistence, and they have conviction. They know if they set the web up properly, they'll catch something, then they'll have something to eat. Not through faith, oh, maybe something will end. No, through conviction and experience. So animals have some of these faculties, but the things that they don't have is the concentration and the wisdom. So if we want to go beyond animal practice, that's what we need to focus on. Make wisdom strong for yourself. It's the governing factor for the other faculties, the spiritual faculties. When they're all in balance, your meditation practice will go fairly smoothly. But do not expect your meditation to go smoothly, right? Because the conditions keep changing. You may be somebody who can't stand hot temperatures. I am one of those people. And where did I go to practice? Burma, Sri Lanka. Yeah, nice hot countries. When it's a low temperature, it's 20 degrees. Yes. When it's high, it's, you know, 50-something. So you start melting. But if you have an expectation, even in such conditions, you have expectation, you're going to suffer. So you let that go. Just think, it'll change. I remember one day walking up and down, walking meditation, up and down, up and down. This was in Sri Lanka. And I was in this concrete hut. And so after about 4 hours of the sun hitting the concrete hut, it had penetrated the whole slab. And inside, it was like an oven. It was just all this heat radiating through from the concrete above. I was baking slowly. I was sitting there for a little while, then I heard, ding! Eggs were done. And I was done too. We're not allowed to cook. I didn't have any eggs, but just for an illustration. So I went outside. I was frustrated. I'm sweating and it's so hot in there. And of course, at nighttime, it's still pumping heat out for another 4 or 5 hours. It's great. Microwave till 10 o'clock at night if you stay in the hut. So if you're outside, you get bitten by the hohoputu, if I pronounce that correctly. It's like a little sand fly. It's just small enough to get through mosquito nets. Yeah. Right. Have I pronounced it correctly? Yes. Okay, great. Sri Lankans are going, what the hell is he talking about? I just think he just said mailboxes. He was attacked by mailboxes. So anyway, I was sick of getting baked, so then I went outside, and then the hohoputu had a piece of the action, and the mosquitoes as well. Because if you're practicing compassion, you should give to all beings. And they all had a slice of the action, the blood here and there, little blood donations. But at that point, I thought, okay, I can't do too much about that, so I just have to give. And I said, may they be happy, may they live another night with this blood donation. All right, trying to take away the mental dart, the mental suffering. Still had the physical suffering, not much I can do about that. And I'm walking up and down and I started kind of feeling miserable for myself, getting a bit depressed. Just thinking, what am I doing in this other country? I'm not born here. I'm not used to these kind of little biting insects here and strange food and chili and all this kind of, what am I doing? I'm going crazy. I must be crazy. But then another thought comes, because then the Dharma side actually kicked in at that point. And is it appropriate to be thinking like this about things which keep changing? Things keep changing. Did you feel, and it's kind of like this internal voice, I don't think I was going mad. This internal voice, was this feeling here at the beginning of the day? No. Was it here like an hour ago? No. Well, is it not likely to go away just as it was not there before and it's here now? Won't it also return to not being here again? Yes. And at that point, my mood had lifted. It's the power of Dhamma. It does this. It shifts things. Hopefully in a good way. It should shift it in a good way if it's Dhamma, not a bad way. Letting go of expectation. Letting go of what you think you should be doing at that point in time or what should be happening at that point in time. I didn't come to Sri Lanka for that experience. I didn't go for Burma for this experience. Blah, 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 blah. If you go with your mind like an open slate that's clean, then something can be left on it. Something can be written down. You can take something away. If you go with a mind full of junk, it's full, there's nothing. There's nothing you can do. You're not going to take anything away. It's like the old Zen story of a Zen master pouring the tea into a cup and the cup of tea keeps pouring and there's a student there, keeps pouring and then starts overflowing and the student's going, oh, no, you should stop. And the teacher's saying, this is just like your mind. It's hard to put anything in when it's already full, right? In other words, it's hard to learn when you think you know everything about the practice. So let it go. If you be in the present moment, let go of your expectations. You will find the meditation path will open up for you. It'll become more smooth, a bit easier. I'm not going to say it's simple. I'm not going to say it's easy. I'm saying easier. And when you start to become familiar with your mind, then you can be able to balance more and more. You balance those faculties, energy and restlessness. You know the difference between the two. I'm feeling a bit slack. I need to give more energy to my practice. I'm a little bit hyper right now. I'm looking for somebody to talk to around the place. I'm looking for a job that involves me talking to somebody else. You see the mind inclining to that. People checking the messages on their phones, even though I said at the beginning of the retreat, turn your phones onto flight mode, because you don't have any important messages, and unless you have a relative who's dying in hospital or a friend dying in hospital. There's no need for us to be on the messages. What are you going to get? I ate cake today. Arthur's going home at 4:30. Look, in every life, you're going to have an Arthur, you know, at four, you know, going home at 4:30. Change Arthur to some other person's name. But here you have an opportunity to drop all of that. In samsara, you always got parents. I like that one. Oh, I can't ordain because I got parents. Oh, I don't. I was born under a mushroom. I don't have family. I don't have sisters. I don't have relatives. No, I'm different. You're strange. You have parents. Me, I manifested in human form. The unicorns were there. It was lovely. This is crazy. All sorts of excuses people come up with. But please put your mobile phones away. Don't use them. All right, apart from alarm clocks or torches. That's okay. But no need for you to get messages from home. If you're going to be filled up with all this garbage. Here we're trying to empty the bin and then you're just getting another bin and just dumping more rubbish into it. Let it go. You don't have to be anybody for the next 5 days if you don't want to be anybody. You don't have to be a father or a mother or a brother or a sister or an accountant or an unemployed person or a student. You don't have to be any of these things. Why do you want to be something? When you're being something, you're going to suffer. And when you're being something, you have the expectation of continuing to be. Drop it all. It'd be great if any one of you became a stream enter on this retreat. It would be fantastic. I don't have that expectation. It'd be great if some of you attained jhana. I don't have that expectation. It'd be great if some of you just appreciated the present moment and just looked around and thought, this is good enough as it is. I like this. This is fine. I know it'll change. Now I really like it tomorrow. So-so. Maybe the day after that, awful. That's okay. At least you're not expecting it. Let it come. It'll come and it'll go. Just like my little episodes of walking outside and inside of this concrete hut in Sri Lanka. In the hut, I was feeling suffering. Then I went outside, I still felt suffering. You know what? You'll find it everywhere if you want to. But the mental affliction, you don't have to cultivate. That comes from the expectation. Like poor old Sona in this sutta, walking up and down, up and down, up and down, and then basically getting on to the point of giving up. Pushing, pushing, pushing. I had that experience myself in a different way. Sitting, sitting, sitting. Wanting something to come from the meditation. After a month, noble silence. Oh. No. And as soon as I gave up, then things shifted. Things changed in a big way. So it was a big teaching for me. It wasn't like some teacher was going, now you got to do this, now you got to do that, now you got to sit like this, you got to walk like that. It's not like that. Wisdom doesn't come from usually those sources. Wisdom will come from inside. There'll be teachers who prod and poke from the corners and the edges to help shift you a little bit, but they can't do all the work for you. You have to move. You have to make that movement, and that movement is that choice to let go of the future, to let go of the past, just to be in the present. And when you do that, you'll find the 1,000 suns or the tens of thousands of suns will come to visit you. Your mind will become radiant, malleable, wieldy, imperturbable. And then all of these qualities that the Buddha talks about will manifest for you. Just like baking a cake, if you mix the ingredients the right way, according to the recipe, you won't end up with a Ford Falcon. You'll end up with a cake. That's what a cake recipe does. It doesn't produce Ford Falcons or Honda Accords, just cakes. Follow the recipe, balance the five faculties of practice, spiritual faculties, you'll get there too. As is said in the Satipatthana Sutta, Just in 7 days, 7 weeks, 7 months, 7 years, you too can attain to this Dhamma. But you have to put yourself into it. Or, I say you put yourself into it so that there's no self out after it. Let go of the expectations. Okay, that is my talk for tonight, the Dhamma talk on Sona, but more importantly, balancing the five spiritual faculties.